Doug Greenwald joins us. Doug is the Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director at Preserving Bible Times, and he's coming to us from Dallas, where he's been marooned for, what, a couple of weeks now. And you're there as the teacher in residence for a month. How's it going?
It is really going well. Mm-hmm. I teach twice on Sunday,
yeah,
once on Monday, once on Tuesday, and once on Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
Then I'm off for a few days and repeat that whole cycle again. So teaching in three different places, and everyone seems to really appreciate context. I'm not sure it's ever crossed their horizon before, mm-hmm. and it's like a whole new world. And I find that exciting, and they seem to find that exciting as well. By the way, I was thinking of auditioning to sing bass in a backup group for a rock band. That's yeah. why my voice is a little bit different.
Well, I think you maybe strained it just a little bit there. You better take it easy with that. You need that voice.
Well, I do, and most of the time I don't have a microphone for whatever reason in the settings I'm in, so I have to amp it up a little bit. But that's not the reason. I just think it's step one of a cold that's just starting in my throat here.
All right. Well, keep that under control. So, context. We've talked about it many times. And why it should be difficult to present or challenging or invite objection, opposition, why it might ruffle feathers is still beyond me, because my first exposure to this, it was like a light going on. And I've seen that from our own church congregation up here when you were here. You've been up here twice now, and each time it's been, wow, lights go on, and people say, where is this stuff? Where's it been all my life?
Well, you use the key word, exposure.
Mm-hmm.
How do you know if you're ever going to like a shrimp cocktail until you actually tasted a shrimp cocktail?
Mm-hmm.
And how do you know that you're going to get excited or intrigued with biblical context if you've never been exposed to it?
Well, but at least I knew what shrimp cocktails were before I ever had one. Context would have been a mystery to me. Like what? Why is that important? I can read what's there. I can see what's there. It's almost like you have to read or sense in a new dimension in order to absorb this, to take it in.
Well, just to go back to shrimp cocktail for a moment, when I first left the Midwest in 1964 to go work as a summer employee at an oil refinery in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, I never knew what a shrimp cocktail was.
Oh.
I never knew what it was to eat fish or crab. I mean, I was just a Midwest pork chop, pot roast, meat and potatoes kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
So that was an eye-opening experience. And I think that's what people need. You know, one of the things I'm working on for our big 3-day summer conference in June in Michigan this summer is a 45 to 60 minute overview of the history of biblical context. And that would be a good answer to your question. How did this come to be? But for at least 1900 years in the history of the church,
check your button there on your mic. There you go.
For the last 1900 years in the history of the church, context has been missing. After the revolt in Israel that started in 66 AD and was crushed in 70 AD, and then reinforced again at the second revolt with Bar Kokhba, that Hadrian crushed in 135 AD, no one in the Christian community in the Gentile world wanted anything to do with anything Judaistic. Because if you're in the Roman Empire, the one thing that Rome never tolerates is sedition, revolt, rebellion. And when you factor in that Israel had a special place in the Roman Empire, it was supposed to be the buffer between the Roman Empire and the Parthians, which we would know as the Persians today,
mm-hmm.
revolt in Israel is doubly persona non grata. And so anything Jewish was anathema.
Well, and again, history is written by the victors. So after Rome vanquished them and closed down the temple and looted Jerusalem, I don't think they got a lot of good press. on the Jewish
side. No, nobody wanted anything to do with anything Jewish. It's really the root of anti-Semitism. And so when you factor in that the Gospels, for example, are really set in village agrarian Jewish setting, none of the images that were used by the Bible writers mean anything to the people in a Roman city of 100,000 people. They're city dwellers. Mm-hmm. They don't understand sheep and shepherding. They don't particularly know how almond trees would have been taken care of. And so not only does nothing translate from the imagery of much of the Bible to Roman city dwellers, but when you overlay this, they revolted, we want nothing to do with them, don't speak a word of anything Jewish, there was a tremendous cleavage of biblical context at the very inception of the faith, basically. For about the first two decades in Jerusalem and Israel, it would be hard to distinguish a Christian from a Jew. They did all the same festivals. They still pretty much ate the same food. The Christians went to the ritual purification baths. The only difference was they embraced Jesus as Messiah, whereas the other Jews, doing all the same thing from a practical, pragmatic behavioral point of view, said, no, I don't think so. Mm-hmm. But they all understood the culture that came with the scriptures. But when this revolt took place, actually the two revolts, there's this great cleavage. And it didn't get put back together until starting maybe around the late 1800s. And then just as it started to get put back together, existentialism rose its head in two seminaries in Germany, Erlangen and Tübingen. And the thing about existentialism is, its point is, I don't need background, I don't need context, I don't need history. The only thing that matters when I read the Bible is, what does it say to me? Mm-hmm. What do I think it means? And so just as biblical context with authors like Edersheim began to put out cultural background kind of stuff, the institutional church, particularly at the seminary level, said, who needs this stuff? And it stayed submerged again. And so it wasn't until maybe, 1970 when Kenneth Bailey started writing, and maybe around 1950 when Joachim Jeremias began start writing about context and history and cultural practices at the time of Jesus, that this thing even began to rear its head. And it reared its head in an anecdotal sort of way. Somebody would make a cultural observation, but they really weren't thinking geography. Or the people specializing in geography would make a geography insight, but they were clueless as to the linguistic issues of a text. So it really hasn't been in the last 20 years that all these pieces have started to become woven together into a unified whole to show us the whole picture of the narrative. So I'm really being super fast here and compressing things. But really, in the last 2,000 years of church history, it's really been only in the last 20 years that we've been able to do integrated contextual exegesis. Exegesis means determination of original meaning. And really see these passages robustly as the people in the first century, when they heard the first words, would have known and understood them. And so what we do here at Preserving Bible Times, and a few others do around the country, is so new over the spectrum of the last 2,000 years, it's like the paint hasn't even dried on it yet.
You know, I think it's interesting to note that as the study of context was being birthed in the 18th and 19th centuries, before existentialism, that a philosophical humanistic force like existentialism would have risen to combat it. That, to me, says Satan, and it says to me that context is essential and very important, and it's worth fighting by his standard.
Yeah, and it's this may be a weak analogy, but if you go over into the history of technology and technology breakthroughs, most innovation comes from outside a given industry. So, for example, Eastman Kodak had a monopoly on image reproduction after World War II, when the United States government bombed both of its competitors, Agfa Gebert in Germany and Fuji in Japan. Mm-hmm. And they had a worldwide lock on image reproduction. And there was a guy in Rochester, New York named Chester Carlson who invented xerography. And he brought it to Eastman Kodak and said, hey, you guys are in their image reproduction business. Why don't you back this technology, you know, and fund it and take it to market? And Eastman Kodak said, well, no one would ever care about that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. We're not interested. And so he found some other investors in Rochester, New York, and xerography and Xerox was created. And, you know, I worked there in the 70s, and it was a phenomenal success. Mm-hmm. Take a look at Apple. Okay? Apple rose outside of IBM. It didn't rise up within IBM, because innovation typically tends to come from outside a company or outside an industry. Well, by association, where do you think innovation is going to come from in this world of integrated biblical context? From seminaries?
Hmm. No. Point well made.
It's going to have to come from outside the seminaries. Hmm. There's a whole lot of structural and historical reasons why, if they give this any attention at all, it's at best anecdotal, and the robust form of it is actually bubbling up from outside the seminary construct, the seminary movement. Not surprising, but it does explain why so many people haven't heard of it or haven't been exposed to it, and why 1,000 pastors that I've met with over the last 15 years all echo the same thoughts that you expressed in the launch here of our program today. Where has this been? How come I was never exposed to it? Where can I get more? And is it possible to get a refund from my seminary education?
Yeah, go ahead, David.
Get your money back from your Sunday school teacher. Yes, yeah. Here's a bright moment, Doug. I asked you last week for a good reference for the last book of the Bible is called Revelation.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, we were going to be doing a home Bible study on Revelation, and I asked you for a good source, and I'm looking at some of those. We picked up the book last week, and the opening lines start out by saying, it was 95 years after the death of Christ. Rome was in charge. I mean, it starts to describe things going on at the time. And I said, wait a minute, these people have been listening to Doug. Or somebody else that said, first of all, you establish what's going on at the time, and you look around and say, this is the way the geography looks, this is the way the cultural looks, or the culture looks, this is what the people were doing. And I said, wow, this is great. It's starting to sink down into the hinterlands. Or maybe this is the aberration. I don't know.
Well, those kind of thoughts prevail in every part of our life, our professional life. And whatever we pursue as a hobby, we need to understand the background and the history. And somehow we have this amazing capacity to unplug that thought when we enter the world of the Bible. But to give you a similar example, a week ago Sunday, I taught the rescue of the demoniac, the rescue and restoration of the demoniac in Luke 8. Uh-huh. And I had visuals, you know, as I began to unpack that story. It's just rich with contextual issues. It's got maybe a dozen of them in there. Mm-hmm. And then I retold the narrative. And then I taught again on Tuesday night. Well, a guy came up to me before the class on Tuesday night who had been in the Sunday class and said, I have to tell you something. I'm in charge of teaching Awana, which is a kid's Christian movement, on Monday night. And on the weekend, I created my message, the story I was going to tell. And then I heard you teach the rescue of the demoniac on Sunday. And I decided to throw out whatever I was going to teach. And I'm just going to retell that story to the kids of the rescue of the demoniac. And he said, you know what? every one of those kids didn't move. And even the youngest kids were just sat there enthralled with this story. Mm. He says, this Bible in context, reconstructing this narrative, it really works. And it works for kids. And he was just stunned, and he was excited, and he was jubilant. And I just nodded my head, you know, and said, yep, heard that one 100 times too.
Yeah.
But these stories are powerful, and because they're stories, they're easy to remember, and they're easy to repeat. And Jesus was the master storyteller. He just wasn't the story. And the conclusion of this ought to be, I don't care whether you're teaching Awana or teaching a Sunday morning sermon, it ought to be a crime to teach a boring lesson or sermon. Mm-hmm. If you can't have your kids on the edge of their seats, or your adults on the edge of their seats after 5 minutes as you create these narratives and restore them, something's wrong.
Mm. Well, Doug, anyway, you and Preserving Bible Times have been planting contextual seeds now for, about 15 years, 16 years maybe now. And now you have helped found something called the Institute of Biblical Context. And this may be the fruit of all that seed planting as it grows. You got the seminar scheduled for Michigan in June, mid-June. And you're developing something called a mosaic. Explain that to us.
Well, it's a mosaic of village life. It's a mosaic of village culture. Because it occurred to me several months ago, so much of what Jesus did took place in a village setting. So much of what he taught took place in a village setting. So much of the encounters he had with people took place in a village setting. In fact, if we had a map on the wall and we were on TV right now, I would draw a triangle from Capernaum, which is on the seashore of the Sea of Galilee, 2 miles north to a town called Chorazin. And then I would draw a line 5 miles to the east to Bethsaida. And then I would connect the last leg of the triangle here from Bethsaida, it's a 6 mile link, back to Capernaum. That little triangle, 2 by 5 by 6 miles, is where Jesus spent 60% of his earthly ministry. It's just hard to fathom. What a small piece of real estate. And basically, there were three main towns and probably several villages in that domain. So here we are. Towns and villages comprise the bulk of the setting where Jesus taught. Those villages are full of context. And I've never been able to read or find anything that summarizes all of the issues culturally at work in a Near Eastern village setting. And so I said, this is something innovative. This is something novel. This is something I think really, really helpful that we will need to have as part of our 3-day curriculum at this Jesus in His Context National Conference we're doing in Western Michigan in June. And just a week ago last night, I taught this for an hour and a half. And I found out where I need to do some smoothing over, and I need to refine some things, and I hopefully will have the bugs all worked out of it by the time that June comes. But I really do think it's a unique contribution, because if you can have this tool in your toolbox, how does a Near Eastern village work? What are the issues? Social reciprocity and mandatory hospitality and ritual purity and other issues of how do you eat, how do you live, what's your house like, how does a synagogue work, how are kids educated. That will give you a great leg up in interpreting and understanding more deeply what Jesus is saying in the encounters and in the teachings that he does that are set in a village setting. So, yeah, that's one of the unique things that will be a part of that weekend. The other one I've already alluded to is no one has ever developed, to my understanding, a history, the 2,000-year history of biblical context, like I briefly alluded to you in the big overview that I did. Mm-hmm. But I want to trace it through the Roman Catholic historic church birth era, you know, in the 500s. Want to take it through the Crusades. Want to take it through the Dark Ages. Want to take it through the Reformation. and help people understand how and why this has been lost for so long in the church, and why only recently has a totally integrated, weaving everything back together approach been alive and well in the last 20 years, to help them appreciate, aren't you glad you're here with us? This has never happened before. This is truly historic. This is truly innovative. And here you are with us as the five of us share our respective insights in what I think will be one of the most cutting edge, digging into the context of the life of Jesus, life and ministry of Jesus, that may have ever been assembled.
Doug, this has to be a book.
Well, it may be a book, not one I'll be around to write, probably. I mean, you have no idea how big these encounters get when they're put back into their own setting. I mean, you know that, but it would be a substantial book, but it would be a marvelous book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, no, I could certainly write the history of biblical context. In fact, I'm thinking of maybe, once the conference is over, making this a new mini-series for my bi-monthly reflections.
Mm-hmm. No, that would be excellent, and that would help you to accumulate material, get a start on the book itself. But I can see that in every church library in the country. That's where it belongs, and we're
yeah. I'm just thinking of a title: What We Missed and How We Missed It.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Biblical context.
What was that went by? Yeah, yeah. And how did we lose it? That in itself is a fascinating story. Why did it disappear? Who brought it back? And how the aspects of this are exciting to contemplate. It would be such a blessing to the church to have that. Again, have it compiled and presented creatively and interestingly, and put me on the list for buying it. David will do the spell checking for you.
Sure.
Yeah.
So be more than happy.
Can you spell ecclesiastical?
Ecclesiastical.
Okay. We'll find someone else then.
Propitiation.
Oh, that's an easy one. Propitiation.
Yeah. Doug Greenwald, Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director at Preserving Bible Times. I'd like to remind all of you that you can link to the Preserving Bible Times website from ours if you're listening at brokenroadradio.com this morning. You can just click on the right-hand side of the homepage there where you see the Preserving Bible Times graphic. It'll take you to the website, which is preservingbibletimes.org. And one, it's a beautiful website. You'll enjoy looking at albums of photos from Italy and from the Holy Land tours that Doug has done. And also DVDs and, of course, Doug's books and other books. And one of the things you might want to glom onto is that 3D, you know, textured map of Israel. And I'm hoping I'm talking about it, Doug. I hope you still got a few of those there, because that's an intriguing thing to have.
It is, and if you'll allow me a PS here on our conversation this morning, this is a thought I've just had in the last couple of days as I continue to mull over the history of biblical context. In the Dark Ages, there were no Bibles. And so the historic Roman Church sort of had as its Bible education strategy asking painters to create biblical scenes. So if you go through the Vatican or any major museum, the paintings of that era are, say, of the return of the prodigal son, or the birth of Jesus, or Jesus doing a miracle for someone. And the backgrounds are fanciful. They're like, all this took place in the Italian countryside with villas on the hilltops.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, noted that. Yeah, you're right.
And everyone is dressed in very colorful robes. Well, Israel was monochromatic. Mm-hmm. And it was stark and barren in a lot of places, in the wilderness. And so even the attempt at biblical education just totally misrepresented to the context of the biblical scenery in the setting. There's just little examples like that over 1900 years, we missed it for a reason, because what we were being exposed to was just inaccurate or fanciful. And if you think about it from another perspective, nobody traveled to Israel. So how is anyone going to discover the land?
Well, people did, but not Christians in that era. It was dangerous.
Well, no. The Crusaders, of course, went to Israel, but not to discover biblical context.
We're talking the Dark Ages here, though. We're talking, 7th, 8th, 9th centuries, and Christian scholars and teachers, whoever they might have been, were lucky just to be alive, and much less able to travel to the Holy Land and do research. I mean,
in fact, modern archaeology is traceable to 1865.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically when Queen Victoria established the Palestinian Exploration Fund, and she began to, bankroll archaeologists to go to Israel. But they didn't go there to discover biblical context. They went there to validate the historicity of the Bible. There was a French archaeologist in 1865 who said, if these 100 sites are ever found in Israel where the Bible says they're to be found, there'll be no question about the accuracy, the inerrancy of the scripture. And so for the longest time, that's what archaeologists were trying to do, validate the scriptures. Well, that explains again why culture of the Holy Land remained dormant for so long, because even archaeologists, which is a fairly new science, weren't focused on it. They were focused on validating the Bible. So there's all these little incidences that really are intriguing, that explain how integrated contextual restoration of a passage has been dormant, has been submerged, has been hidden for so long, except for maybe the last 20, 25 years. It's an exciting point in time for those of us who are in biblical context. And we love sharing it with the remnant of God's kingdom to this moment in time who are interested in it.
Well, it's exciting to see you in Preserving Bible Times bringing us back the context of context as well. I think that's a noble endeavor, and Godspeed to you. And we'll see you back next Wednesday, Hope, with your voice in a little better shape. And don't hurt that.
Thanks, guys.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Doc.